new taxes, no new taxes, unless there's a pandemic. Saudi Arabia is tripling its tax rate.
In Saudi Arabia, people are just not used to being taxed. So this is kind of a new twist on autocratic governance in the Persian Gulf region.
Also, will the pandemic be the final act for coal?
It's just added an extra reminder that the financial risks of investing in coal, it's technologically and economically obsolete.
And trying to follow presidential campaigns as a first-time voter during a pandemic.
It's just draining and overwhelming.
Plus, in South Korea,
you're going to be happy, you're going to have handsome boyfriends, and your life problem is all going to be solved if you just do one thing.
But it's not easy. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. Leaders from across the globe are blasting President Trump today over his threat to pull U.S. funding for the World Health Organization during a pandemic. Last night, President Trump broadsided the WHO's annual assembly with a stinging letter delivered via Twitter and said if the organization doesn't make reforms within 30 days, he'll stop American funding permanently. Today, China's foreign ministry spokesman Zhao Lijiang said the U.S. was trying to shift blame away from, quote, its own incompetent response. Australia's Kevin Rudd said withdrawing funding would be grossly irresponsible for developing countries. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said there may be the need for future reforms of the WHO, but right now we need global unity and cooperation.
In times like these, the greatest act of courage is to play as a team.
Still today, member states of the WHO back the idea of independently reviewing how the WHO has handled the coronavirus. Suri Moon has been following all of these developments closely. She joins us from Geneva, where she's a leading voice on global health governance. Suri, what is this resolution about an independent inquiry all about? Let's start there.
I think there's widespread support for a review, of course, not only of WHO, but in fact of what a number of different governments around the world have done to respond to this outbreak. And it makes perfect sense. I think the big question is about what is the appropriate timing and how do we make sure that any kind of review is, in fact, truly independent and impartial. But nobody spoke against doing any kind of review. And I think it was quite significant that President Xi Jinping of China, in fact, also supported a review, but not at this time.
Right. And when you say timing, you mean the WHO would kind of conduct an audit of their performance after the pandemic? What would be the timing on that?
I think we have to be past a crisis period. And right now, we need all hands on deck. I think it's already a major challenge for WHO to try to be coordinating the international response. It's still early days. We don't have effective treatment. We don't have enough PPE for everyone around the world. We certainly don't have a vaccine. And the cases are growing in all major regions of the world right now. It doesn't mean you put it off indefinitely, but that it would be a harmful distraction, a destructive distraction right now.
Is the resolution for an independent review of the WHO a response to Donald Trump's relentless criticism of the organization, or have there been concerns by other countries as well?
I do think that the fact that this was included in the resolution, which was passed by consensus, reflects a strong push by the U.S. government. It does reflect the fact that a number of countries do share some of Donald Trump's concerns that we don't have full information, for example, about the origins of the virus, that there are questions, I think, about the extent to which information was shared by the Chinese authorities in the early days of the outbreak back in December and January of this year. However, what's interesting to note is that once other governments got involved in trying to agree, what is a reasonable review to call for, you saw that a number of other conditions were added. I think there's widespread recognition that the number of the key actors who dropped the ball in responding to these outbreaks are national governments, and that does not exclude the U.S. government. And so I think an important feature of this resolution is that it's calling for a comprehensive review that doesn't only look at WHO.
Have member states come to the defense of the WHO's director general, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus?
Almost every single statement that a government made during the assembly expressed support and appreciation both for the WHO and oftentimes for the director general himself. I think there is a widespread perception that the U.S. decision to withhold funding and to really target blame on WHO in the middle of a historic pandemic is short-sighted. It is self-serving. It seems to be motivated by domestic political considerations. The way in which the U.S. has gone about pushing for certain changes, I think, has been counterproductive in that it has alienated many, many other countries in the world.
When all is said and done, does the WHO come out of this Global Health Assembly meeting standing tall or somewhat diminished?
I think the WHO comes out of this assembly with deep, deep support from the international community. And this is countries from all regions of the world, with the notable exception of the U.S. Of course, this is the biggest challenge that WHO has faced in the 70 years of its existence. And it has very treacherous political waters that it has to navigate ahead of it. I think the Trump letter coming, you know, right in the middle of a two-day assembly certainly was disruptive. But what is notable is that you had heads of state speaking at the beginning of the assembly before the letter, and you had heads of state speaking after the letter came in, and there was no change in tone. There was no change in the kind of expressions of political support for the organization, for international cooperation, for multilateral approaches that were expressed across regions and across all kinds of political ideologies. And I do hope that there will be a change in attitude soon in the White House, in Washington, regarding how it engages with the international community on this pandemic.
Sari Moon is co-director of the Global Health Center at Geneva's Graduate Institute. She's been speaking with us from Geneva. Sari, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
A Saudi aviation student who killed three U.S. sailors at a Navy base in Pensacola, Florida in December had ties to al-Qaeda. That's according to U.S. officials this week, who say they uncovered those connections by breaking into the gunman's two iPhones. They did that, they said, without any help from Apple and blasted the company for allegedly slowing down the investigation. Here's the world's Lydia Emanuelidou.
After the attack in December, it didn't take long for authorities to turn their attention to the two phones that belonged to the gunman.
It was clear at the time that the phones were likely to contain very important information.
This is U.S. Attorney General William Barr at yesterday's press conference. He said that within one day of the shooting, the FBI got court orders authorizing them to search the phones. But they were locked, and the FBI didn't have the passwords it needed to get in.
And we asked Apple for assistance, and the president asked Apple for assistance. Unfortunately, Apple would not help us.
Eventually, the FBI broke into the phones on its own, but U.S. officials say that Apple's unwillingness to help seriously hampered the investigation. Apple denies this accusation, which was made over and over again at this 36-minute press conference. In a statement it gave to the world, Apple said it did work with U.S. law enforcement and handed over some data it had access to. Apple accused U.S. officials of making, quote, false claims about the company, claims they say were an excuse to weaken security measures that make it nearly impossible for anyone, even Apple itself, to get into users' phones and access their data. The U.S. government wants the company to change that, to build a backdoor of sorts that law enforcement can use to get into phones for investigations. Apple is strongly against this. Here's CEO Tim Cook speaking at a Wall Street Journal event a few years ago.
The key sort of tenets that we feel very strongly about is that you can't have a backdoor in the software, because you can't have a backdoor that's only for the good guys, that any backdoor is something that bad guys can exploit.
These bad guys could be criminals. They could also be authoritarian governments. Cook said creating this backdoor would be like building the software equivalent to cancer. Weakening Apple's encryption technology could have huge implications for the privacy and human rights of the hundreds of millions that use iPhones around the world. This isn't the first time Apple's gone head-to-head with U.S. law enforcement on this issue. It happened under the Obama administration, too, following a terror attack in California in 2015.
One of the world's biggest tech companies is facing off in court against the FBI.
Apple is refusing to follow a government order to hack the San Bernardino shooter's phone.
What I think you ought to do is boycott Apple until such time as they give that security number. How do you like that? I just thought it.
then candidate, now President Donald Trump and his administration haven't stopped going after Apple. The U.S. and global allies have put pressure on other companies, too, like Facebook, to weaken their encryption standards. Yesterday, Attorney General Barr said the Trump administration was looking into legislative fixes for this, something that privacy and human rights advocates say could be disastrous. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
After months of quarantines and shutdowns, many cities around the world are slowly opening up, getting back as close to normal as possible. In Hong Kong, a semi-autonomous part of China, getting back to normal means getting back to protests. As The World's Patrick Nguyen reports, the movement is now centered around a song.
There's this song that's suddenly quite controversial, but it's not lewd. There's no profanity. It's actually mostly just choral singing. Opening line goes, "Arise, ye who would not be slaves." "March on," it goes, and "roar defiance," which is ironic because this is the national anthem of China. And pretty soon, if you disrespect this song in Hong Kong, you might go to jail for up to 3 years.
Hong Kong authorities are moving to push through a controversial national anthem law.
Just a draft law for now, but the leader of Hong Kong's government, Carrie Lam, she's been pushing it for years.
Protecting the dignity of the national anthem is the obligation and responsibility of the Hong Kong SAR government, and indeed of any Chinese national.
But why pass a new anthem law now? Well, because they're gearing up for another round of protests. Now that the coronavirus threat is winding down, demonstrators are heading back into the streets to roar defiance. That's from last week, protesters versus police in a shopping mall. That sound, plink, plink, that's riot cops firing pepper balls, like paintballs that really, really sting. Now, good luck making any of those protesters sing the Chinese national anthem. They think the Communist Party are tyrants, Hong Kong's leaders are puppets, and they are waging a, quote, revolution to keep Hong Kong at least quasi-independent from China. The protesters, they actually have their own anthem. Sounds like it's from the 1800s, but that was written last year. It talks about blood and rage and, quote, the dread that lies ahead. Pro-Beijing media called this song poisonous. And when it came out, China started really promoting the official Chinese anthem in Hong Kong, putting out videos of famous locals singing it, people like Jackie Chan. This proposed law against insulting the Chinese anthem, how do you break it? By booing the song? By singing the protesters' counter-anthem, which they sing at every rally? Hard to say. The draft law is vague. And that's why local lawmakers who support the protests are fighting to stop it. And it's not going so well. That's a scuffle just yesterday inside Hong Kong's legislature. Security guards dragging out pro-democracy lawmakers, other guards protecting pro-Beijing politicians, who just got control of a committee that will decide the fate of the anthem law. All signs suggest they'll get it passed soon. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Coming up, coal, no longer the king? You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Lockdowns have thrown global energy markets into turmoil. Flights are canceled. Factories are shuttered. Energy use is way down. So are carbon emissions that drive climate change. A new study out today says global greenhouse gas emissions have plunged 17%. The world's Anna Kussmer has been digging in, and it seems a big dip in coal usage accounts for a lot of that drop. Anna, let's start with the big picture here. What's happening in energy markets overall around the world right now?
Electricity demand has gone down an average of 20%. And the first quarter of 2020 has seen a 4% dip in energy use overall. Just about every fuel type has been affected by that. But as you just mentioned, coal has been hit the hardest.
Yeah, so why in this whole energy picture is coal taking that big hit?
what's happening in India right now, which is the world's second biggest coal consumer, I think is a good example for what's happening to coal in a lot of places. Coal accounts for about 70% of their energy generation. But as the demand has gone down, almost all of the energy that's been taken offline are coal plants. And that's not just happening in India. That's happening in a lot of places.
So, Anna, what kind of long-term impact is this pandemic likely to have on the coal industry overall?
The coal industry has already been suffering around the world, and that's because of how inefficient coal-fired power plants are compared to other sources of energy in many countries. And also, they're really bad for air quality and carbon emissions. You know that Bob Dylan expression, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so the wind is not blowing towards coal in a lot of these places. Here's Tim Buckley at the Institute of Energy Economics and Financial Analysis in Sydney, Australia, talking about the lockdown's impact on coal.
It was already economically challenged, and now all of a sudden, trying to run a coal plant profitably is almost impossible. It's just added an extra reminder that the financial risks of investing in coal, it's technologically and economically obsolete.
Anna, you made the point earlier that coal is bad for air quality. What does the drop in coal usage mean for carbon emissions? What can you say about that?
So of all the fuel sources out there, burning coal is the worst impact when it comes to carbon emissions. India's drop in coal burning has resulted in India's emissions going down for the first time in 4 decades, which is remarkable. Emissions are down around the world, and the drop is most intense in countries that burn a lot of coal.
With coal continuing its downward slide, does that mean renewables will now fill the void and just naturally become a larger share of the energy market?
Renewables have had basically the opposite fate than coal. Brent Wanner at the International Energy Agency says this boost in renewables and the kind of crash of coal is the continuation of a trend that we've already been seeing.
This follows an important turning point in 2019, which marked the first time in history that global coal-fired generation was overtaken by low-carbon sources.
So in India and many other countries, renewables were the energy source that were hurt the least by the lockdowns, although the industry has been hurt. I mean, supply chains have been messed up and a lot of jobs have been lost. So it's not a full win for renewables. They've just been the least hurt during a very tumultuous time.
What are analysts expecting in the long term? Do they say these trends that you've been describing are going to continue?
In the short and medium term, things could go in just about any direction. In China, the world's biggest energy market and the biggest user of coal, I should mention, energy demand and emissions shot up in May after dropping in March and April. Here's Lori Muluvetta at the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air in Helsinki, Finland.
The big question is this short-lived or is this the start of a dirty rebound, and that really depends on the decisions that the Chinese policymakers will be taking in the next weeks.
Leaders could decide to bail out coal, or they could use this big disruption to go another way. And that's true of so many countries, and it's definitely true of India as well. So just because the economic and financial wind is blowing away from coal and towards renewables, that doesn't mean that governments will necessarily go in that direction.
Anna Kussmer, environment producer here at The World. Thanks very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Each Tuesday, we bring you the story of a young, first-time Latino voter as part of our series Every 30 Seconds. We named it that because every 30 seconds, a young Latino in the U.S. turns 18, voting age. Today, we hear from a 17-year-old in Seattle whose life, like all of ours, has been upended by the coronavirus.
Hello, my name is Michelle Aguilar Ramirez. I'm a junior at the moment. I feel as though the pandemic has impacted me in various ways that I never really thought would really matter to me. I feel like it's really the whole, like, staying quarantined has really messed with my mental health. I haven't had the opportunity to, like, really, like, go and socialize with other individuals except for the people who I live with. I haven't had the opportunity to, like, really feel happy in a way. As for online school, I honestly, truly hate it. I don't know how much I can express how much I hate digital learning. I'm the kind of person that needs reassurance from my professor, from the individuals that are in my surroundings in the classroom. The most that I can do is like do a video chat, like through Zoom or something with my classmates and my professor, which is like really hard for me and kind of awkward, honestly. It's hard because I don't really have the best Wi-Fi on my end. It's also been hard for me to, like, stay on track with certain assignments because I confuse the days because of so many days that I've been, like, inside and cooped up. And since it's so many people live here, I don't have a specific space where I can do my homework at peace with no noise whatsoever. So, like, any time of the day, everyone is, like, watching the TV. There's an Xbox going on. There's, like, YouTube going on the tablet or Fortnite. And it's so much noise. I feel like my mental health is, like, already, like, going downhill because of the quarantine. And for me to have to listen to, like, all this draining information, and that overwhelms me a lot. I barely have any time to, like, hang out, like, with my family now or anything. I'm not keeping myself posted with all the news that's coming out, whether it's political or whether it's about the elections, because it's just draining and overwhelming. I'll probably start keeping myself posted on certain things, but as of now, I could care less about that specifically because I'm just busy with my own things, with my mental health, with my physical health, and with academics. I know that's, like, bad on my behalf, but, like, I feel like that's, like, the best that I can do.
Esme Jimenez from KUOW in Seattle and the world's Uzera Emud produced our story. Michelle Aguilar Ramirez is one of 32 million Latinos who will be eligible to vote in the U.S. presidential election this fall. Tomorrow, the world hosts a Facebook Live forum about this crucial voting bloc. The world's Daisy Contreras, editor of the Every 30 Seconds Project, talks with Maria Teresa Kumar of Voto Latino and Mark Hugo Lopez, director of Hispanic Research at the Pew Research Center. Send your questions to myworld@theworld.org and join us online tomorrow at noon Eastern. News headlines are just ahead. You're listening to The World. It's time to go back to school in South Korea, but Korea is still recording new cases of the coronavirus. So many students are nervous. They worry that their classmates won't follow the new protocols.
Some boys never wash hands, and I hate that. Personal hygiene is so, so, so important.
That's still coming up here on The World. A pandemic, by definition, is bad. But you really know how bad things are, economically at least, when one of the world's richest nations, Saudi Arabia, is calling for shared economic sacrifice. Oil has meant Saudis are used to generous benefits and few taxes. The kingdom imposes no personal income tax. Saudis do pay a modest value-added tax on goods, but that tax is tripling to 15%. At the same time, the kingdom is slashing benefits for its subjects. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Napt Finjan is one of the mini coffee shops that have sprung up in Saudi Arabia in the past few years.
That's it? Sorry, ma'am. For here or to go?
For here. It's a cozy little place. Brick walls, soft music, young Saudis sipping lattes. 2 years ago, when I visited, this cafe seemed to have a lot going for it. Today, it sits empty. There's just the baristas making coffee drinks to go. Jim Crane is an energy expert at Rice University. He says the pandemic has hit Saudi Arabia's economy hard. That's because it relies so much on one commodity, oil.
You've got something like a third of the world's people, you know, not moving around, not traveling like they normally do. When you have people on lockdown, you basically have oil demand on lockdown.
The price of oil has dropped to historically low levels, Crane says. And that's not all. Saudi Arabia used to make a lot of money from religious tourism. That has dried up. And then there are the thousands of businesses that have had to close down as the disease spread.
So they're in a tight spot on three levels.
Shukran akhi Nasser wa hayyakallah hayyallah al-sada al-mushahideen.
Earlier this month, Saudi Finance Minister Mohammed al-Jaddan went on state TV. He told the nation that starting July 1st, they'll have to pay a 15% tax on all goods and services. This is a crisis we haven't seen before, he said. The changes will be painful for everyone, but they're for the benefit of our country. Jim Crane says the tax hike took many by surprise.
Well, it's really unusual. I mean, so the Saudis basically abolished almost all taxes in the 1970s after the big oil boom.
Since then, the only time that the Saudi government imposed new taxes was in 2018, and that was just 5%. Crane says there's a reason why autocratic countries are cautious about raising taxes.
It gives people who are contributing to the government budget an incentive to say how their contributions should be spent.
In Saudi Arabia, it's the royal family who's in charge, so the public doesn't have a say on how government money is spent. Joanne Clark, a tax expert in Dubai, says the Saudi government did signal a tax increase last year.
I think everybody expected it would be to maybe 7%, 10%. Nobody, I would say, predicted that it would jump as high as 15%.
Clark says some business owners are worried about losing customers to other Gulf countries that have lower taxes, like Oman or Kuwait. Abdullah Arab teaches sociology at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. He says his relatives in Saudi Arabia are already reconsidering big purchases.
One of them, for example, told me I was planning to buy a house. Now I need to consider if I'm going to buy the house now or wait.
Arab says even with these new taxes, Saudis are well cared for. Healthcare is free, so is education. The government supports the poor, and right now it's paying up to 60% of salaries because of the lockdown. That's been the case for Dima Fetiani. She's a business consultant in Jeddah, a city in western Saudi Arabia. Fetiani says she's been helping small businesses in her city, coffee shops like the one I visited. Fetiani says the new taxes make good financial sense and they're long overdue.
We didn't need a pandemic to understand that we've been spoiled for decades right now. But we need to take an action and take responsibility and be part, a real part of this country.
Fetiani says she trusts the Saudi government to get the country through this crisis. If anything, it's the people in the U.S. that she's worried about. We've heard a lot of people have died there, she tells me. Do you have enough gloves and masks? Well, that's another story. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Like nations everywhere, India and Bangladesh are trying to contain coronavirus outbreaks. On top of that, they're also preparing for a cyclone with 165 mile per hour winds. That's equivalent to a Category 5 hurricane. The governments of India and Bangladesh are trying to evacuate hundreds of thousands of people ahead of the storm, which is expected to make landfall tomorrow. Shamarendra Karmakar is a retired director of Bangladesh's meteorological department. He joins us from Bangladesh's capital, Dhaka. What can you tell us about this storm, Cyclone Amphan?
It is already weakened slightly in the afternoon, late afternoon, with sustained wind speed of about 200 kilometers, gusting to 220 kilometers, and may weaken a little more during landfall.
So you're looking at wind speeds now between 120, 150, but expecting some weakening. The people most at risk to the severe flooding live in coastal cities. They live in mud and wooden shacks. Where is the government evacuating these people to? Are there shelters and are they adequate?
I think government is taking a lot of preparation. They are making the shelters ready. They have increased the number of shelters because the schools are now closed because of corona. So that will be used also. And the volunteers of, you know, cyclone preparedness program, they are already at the coastal areas and requesting the people to take shelter in the cyclone shelters. That is what I have seen from the news.
So among the people in very basic shacks are about a million Rohingya refugees who fled the ethnically driven massacres in Myanmar a few years ago. And they've been living in this giant refugee camp, Cox's Bazar, in Bangladesh. What do you know about their situation? Do they have enough space to relocate?
I think Cox's Bazar region will be less impacted area because it is likely to make landfall through the western, southwestern, that is in the Indian and Bangladesh border area. So coastal area of Cox's Bazar and Chittagong, I think that will be less affected. So the Rohingya people who are in the tent, I think they'll not be impacted so much, but there will be some thunderstorms, rainfall, something like that, what is usual during this time.
I've read that across Bangladesh, some people are hesitant to evacuate. Why do you think that is?
It happens always in our country or in other countries also. What I have seen that the people, they don't like to go to the shelter sometimes. And there are many reasons for this. And this year, you know, Corona is a new edition and it is a new issue. And they may think that the social distance will not be maintained properly. That may also create a problem among them this year. But government has requested them, the people, to use masks and increase the number of shelters for maintaining some social distance among the people.
I just learned today that about 40% of global storm surges hit Bangladesh. In fact, some of the deadliest cyclones have hit Bangladesh in the past half century. As you say, now there's coronavirus. How prepared do you think Bangladesh really is for the effects of this storm?
The people are now aware than before. So this is my thinking, that the people will be going to the shelter and also take precautions in this case.
Well, we are very glad to hear the precautions are being taken. Shamarendra Karmakar is a retired director of Bangladesh's meteorological department. He's been speaking with us from Bangladesh's capital, Dhaka. Shamarendra, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
As Cyclone Amphan barrels toward Bangladesh and India, there's new evidence this week proving that hurricanes and cyclones have gotten more intense over the past four decades. The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler is here to explain this new link between hurricanes and our warming world. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Marco. So we've definitely talked before about the link between hurricanes and climate change. And when we did, I would say something like hurricanes are expected to grow more intense as the world warms. That's because physics dictates, and computer modeling also shows, that as we add heat to our oceans and air, we're adding more potential energy to storm systems, so more energy that can turn into higher winds. But this week, for the first time, scientists have been able to actually look back and say that as our world has warmed, these hurricanes, typhoons, or cyclones, depending on where you are in the world, have already gotten more intense.
Yeah, so how much stronger are we talking here?
So this new study, which was published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, showed that every decade for the past four decades, basically the likelihood of a hurricane developing into a major hurricane, Category 3 or higher, has risen about 8% per decade.
So if this is something models have shown for years and it makes intuitive sense with the laws of physics, why is this now just being proved?
Well, it's hard to study hurricanes. There aren't that many of them, which makes it hard to draw these big conclusions about them. And it's hard to compare storms over the decades and around the world because the way we've studied them has changed as satellite technology has changed. And we also measure them differently in different places around the world. So, for example, in the Atlantic, we still send these hurricane hunting planes into the eyes of hurricanes to measure the wind speeds. That doesn't really happen regularly in other places. So the researchers who published this study had to come up with a way to compare hurricanes and cyclones from 40 years ago with ones that happened just a few years ago. And they did that by studying things like cloud patterns and infrared temperature readings on satellite images in order to derive these sort of apples-to-apples comparisons.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Sudan must pay billions of dollars in punitive damages to victims of two bombing attacks in 1998 at U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. That is the ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court this week. The attacks were carried out by al-Qaeda operatives. Between the two embassies, the bombings killed hundreds of people and wounded thousands of others. Besides the payment, the court's ruling sends a strong message to governments that sponsor terrorism. As the world's Halima Gikandi reports, it comes as the Sudanese government is trying to get off the U.S. terrorism list.
It was a unanimous decision. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Sudan must pay more than $4 billion to hundreds of victims of two terrorist attacks on U.S. embassies in 1998. Most of the victims were Kenyans and Tanzanians who had worked in the embassies. They have been fighting in the courts with the Sudanese government for years. Gabriel Marion is one of the lawyers representing them. He says Sudan has not paid a single cent so far, despite previous court rulings.
The attack itself sets off a lifetime of other problems and other suffering, you know, that are all connected, really.
Sudan wants to get off the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. The State Department put the country on the list in 1993. And now, many Sudanese say U.S. sanctions tied to that listing are choking the economy. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He also advised the Bush administration on Sudan policy.
I think that Sudan has to put these cases behind them once and for all. If the requirement is that they have to pay, then that's the requirement.
But many in Sudan say that the country doesn't have the money to pay out billions of dollars in compensation to victims. The government is saddled with large debts. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok is the head of the new civilian-led Sudanese government. He spoke about the terrorism listing during a visit to Washington in December.
This issue has a lot of bearing on so many processes, not to mention the debt, investment, but also opening the country.
The U.S. State Department says it's working with Sudan to figure out a way to meet these obligations. Here's Assistant Secretary for African Affairs Tibor Naj in January.
There are some thorny issues involved which have to be overcome. We want a successful Sudan. We want to be partners for Sudan. So we are working together on this.
But lawyers representing the victims of the embassy bombing say they're worried. Gabriel Marion tells me that the U.S. has proposed a tiered payment system. Foreign nationals who worked at the embassies, he says, would receive less than 10% of what American victims are expecting. And he says that includes foreign nationals who have since become American citizens.
It's going to be to discriminate against African Americans and Africans. And pay U.S. citizens $10 million, and those guys either nothing or, you know, a couple hundred thousand.
A State Department official sent me an email today that said it has reached a preliminary agreement with Sudan to settle these claims. That agreement has been sent to Congress. It would provide compensation to both U.S. citizens and non-citizens, but it didn't say how much. Cameron Hudson from the Atlantic Council says the Trump administration is trying to strike a balance between supporting a new democracy in Sudan and holding the government there accountable.
There is a risk that Sudan will continue to keep this tied up in courts. There's an opportunity to get some payment now. You've waited 20 years to get anything.
Any final deal on those financial claims would need to be passed in Congress. For the World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
75 years ago, the globe was emerging from the Second World War. Countries came together to create a global organization that they hoped would prevent human rights atrocities from happening again. I'm talking, of course, about the United Nations. This year, as the UN recognizes its 75th year, it's also evaluating how it needs to evolve at a so-called People's Forum. The world's Rupa Shenoy has more.
The coronavirus pandemic forced the United Nations to hold its 75th anniversary People's Forum online, allowing for what might have been the biggest conversation ever about the way the UN works. Some 2,000 officials, activists, and advocates from dozens of countries attended. And from the outset, one theme was clear. The UN hasn't been effective enough in getting governments to work together. Andreas Bummel is founder of Democracy Without Borders, Germany.
Battle lines are shaping, with some seeing an opportunity to feed nationalism, xenophobia, and focus on one's own country, my government, my people, and forget about the rest of the world.
Several speakers pointed out that countries with nationalist agendas were spreading disinformation on social media and marginalizing the people who advocate for global solutions to global problems like climate change and the current pandemic. Song Yong-yoon is UN representative for the International Alliance for Women.
We are experiencing an assault on science, an assault against our UN agencies like WHO and also processes like the Paris Climate Accord.
Not only has the UN struggled to corral nations to work together, it's also struggled to hold individual nations accountable for human rights abuses. Emilia Reyes of the organization Equidad de Género Mexico said that the UN investigators who document these abuses are often ignored.
The UN system is actually undermining and dismissing the recommendation of all of these very powerful human rights UN rapporteurs.
Many argued that the current structure of the UN isn't actually serving people. It's serving governments. Bridget Burns is director of the Women's Environment and Development Organization in New York.
Really, the UN right now doesn't feel fit for serving the global good as opposed to serving the interests of nation states.
Nation states that aren't necessarily interested in protecting poor people or the environment. Fergus Watt is executive director of the World Federalist Movement Canada. He, like many others, suggested the UN invite more citizen engagement.
Perhaps it's time that we think about ways that we can lift up the role of citizen representatives at the UN.
Watt recommended a new system of elected citizen representatives who would take part in UN deliberations and have direct input, perhaps through new technology. But Silvio Gonzato, head of the European Union delegation to the UN, cautioned there would be challenges to more citizen involvement. He said that some countries have opposed their citizens being admitted to UN conferences in the past.
We've been fighting for keeping these conferences open to civil society. Some member states do not agree with that. They want to be able to object. We want this objection process to be as transparent as possible.
The UN General Assembly will consider that change and others that might increase citizen involvement over the next month. It's expected to ratify a 75th anniversary declaration in September, setting out a shared vision for a common future. For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Schools in South Korea start reopening tomorrow. Students will have their temperatures checked before they enter school buildings. Anyone presenting COVID-19-like symptoms will be sent home immediately. It's just high school seniors going back for now. As Jason Strother reports from Seoul, kids there could not wait to get back.
South Korean students haven't heard one of these jingles in quite a while. This is the melody that plays over school intercoms to let everyone know that class is about to begin. The school year in this country begins in March, but it was delayed because of, you know what. Teachers have been doing classes online, but many high school seniors, like 18-year-old Jung Yujin, say they've had enough of virtual learning. They're really ready to get back to the classroom. I talk with Jung at a crowded cafe. She says students are panicking. They feel like they're falling behind. They're worried, Jung says, that they won't be able to get into good colleges now. South Korea's education ministry made an exception for high school seniors and let them return to school before everyone else because they have a, quote, urgent academic need. That includes preparing for the university entrance exam, known as the Sunung. The test is usually held in November, but it was already pushed back to December this year to give students more time to study. Park Ji-yoon, who's 17, is worried too.
Online 수업도 수업을 듣는 거긴 하지만 학교에서 듣는 게 아니기 때문에.
She says a few extra weeks just isn't enough. Park is a senior who wants to study tourism in college and says online classes just don't cut it. Her goal is to get into the right college major. Now, Park says, starting her career after college is going to be much more difficult. For a lot of students in South Korea, the senior year and especially the Sunung exam is the time to make it or break it.
There's a very narrow conception of what it means to be successful in Korean society.
Ji Young Lee previously taught high school in South Korea. Now she's working on a PhD in education at the University of Washington in Seattle. Lee says seniors are under immense pressure from everyone around them to ace the Sunung.
Students believe what parents and teachers tell them, that, you know, if you become a doctor, if you become a lawyer, or if you are a good student who scores high, your life is just going to be fine. You're going to be happy. You're going to have pretty or handsome girlfriends or boyfriends, and your life problem is all going to be solved if you just do one thing. And, you know, consequently, if you can't score high, then your life is worthless.
Lee says this year's seniors are at a disadvantage compared to other graduating classes. Some students and their parents are trying to compensate. They're ramping up on private tutoring. 17-year-old Eun Soo-yeon has been going to a test prep academy for the past few weeks. Eun says she's not too stressed out, but that's not the case for many of her classmates.
Many students feel that university is almost most of the student's life, so they're really freaked out.
Eun says she's more concerned about going back to school while Korea is still recording new COVID-19 infections. Around 200 additional cases were reported in the past 2 weeks. Eun says even though her school tells students to wear masks and wash their hands, she doesn't trust that all of her classmates are doing what they should be doing.
Some boys never wash hands, and I hate that. Personal hygiene is so, so, so important, so I want my boys to wash their hands.
Eun says for the first day of school this year, she's packing some extra bottles of hand sanitizer. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
And with that, class dismissed. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.